Welcome, everybody, to the Brian Picarossi podcast. That's me. So great to have Allison share with us, talking about her new book, second book. You were on previously for your former book, Millennial's Guide to Changing the World. And now your new book, which, when does it come out?
I'm not quite sure yet, but I'm hoping before the November election for kind of time.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
And you said this is the first podcast that you've on this book
Yeah, this
that
is
you've
my
done?
first time publicly speaking about it.
Fantastic. So an exclusive for now. So I have one technical question before like we go into the book itself, which is like I'm interested in your process, your creative process for like writing and like what do you have a set time every day that you would work on the book or how would that work for you?
Well, I should, but I don't. I'm definitely going to be moving into a more structured writing schedule, but for this book in particular, it's been a kind of like inner battle on whether or not I should release it. So for me, my process has mainly been like getting all the different parts of myself aligned, deciding that I'm actually going to do this professionally and invest all that is required to like get a book out and message across and be the voice of that message. So that's really what the majority of my energy has been thus far. But I do have a proposal written and chapters written, which I showed my agent and started getting feedback on the concept and actually did a bunch of tweaking based on that feedback.
Okay. And you've been conflicted because is it because you feel like there may be some like it's controversial or there may be some backlash or
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and then also like my family alliances and needing to get their support as well. So that was also like a big kind of, I guess you could say, like healing was that my parents are fully supportive of me putting out this book, which deals with the pandemic and politics and public health policy, and that's very much their professional wheelhouse. So that was like the final deciding factor. I was like, I'm not gonna push this if it's gonna like tear apart my family. So yeah.
Well, let's I think now we should articulate, explain what the book is about, and then also who your parents are, since you put that forward as well.
Yeah, so the book kind of, I started writing it during the pandemic when we were all in lockdown, just because I like how I sense make is through writing, and I was trying to figure out, what was really going on, as I think many of us were, and I think many of us had pretty profound paradigm shifts politically, given the research and the information that gathered. I feel like the left people who once identified more as like leftist in their policy views, like now became more moderate, more centrist, started to see logic behind some conservative ideals. And yeah, so I was just writing and exploring all the different things that were happening from the BLM protests to the anarchists creating, cities inside of, where was it? In Portland and
Seattle,
Seattle.
yeah.
So like what I saw was like all these different polarizations inside of society and belief systems like erupting, and the biggest kind of fight was around constitutional rights and even a big debate around the scientific method and the scientific process and kind of like this epistemological absurdism that has arisen, where if science is the way that we have traditionally been able to look and find like objective truths, objective patterns in the world, like are there divided loyalties there? Like how does the actual industry of science work? And then, because of my parents, my father, and actually most of my dad's side of the entire family has worked on vaccine technology and has developed like many different types of vaccines. My father works very closely with Tony Fauci. My mother works very closely with Bill Gates. They're both pretty high up in public health policy. So there was also this deep split inside of me that I needed to reconcile around, essentially like global protests happening over my parents' work and being with my parents and like seeing how desperately they were trying to save lives. And so that's a part of it, but also a huge figure in the book is Trump and how his presidency and how the media has portrayed him two very different lights has created almost like a culture war inside of America, and how this upcoming election, it seems like things have really calmed down, but I'm imagining they might start to get roused up again if he makes it, into the final election, which he probably will, right? So just him alone as a figure brings up so much pain for people. And it seems to me like the split is around the right wing, and they can be quite radical, but them thinking that he is a somewhat like messiah of sorts, like draining the swamp and tackling governmental corruption as this outsider, and that there are these larger conspiracies happening inside of America to take away our rights, bring us into this globalist communist dystopia, and he's the one fighting it. Also, like China is a huge figure here around are we under attack from China? What are Biden's alliances with China? And then with the left, there's all this concern over structural and institutional racism, sexism, moving towards socialist interventions to ameliorate the struggles, the economic struggles that the average American has in America. So
I think homophobia and transphobia is also big in that scene as well.
right. So this whole like identity politics thing became so prevalent, and then going into all that and the psychology of that and how I think personally destructive it is to kind of identify yourself as a victim based on your identity and the kind of culture war that was happening around that, but then also like realizing the legitimacy of people's experiences dealing with homophobia, transphobia, racism, and it is stuff that kind of becomes a pressure cooker for people and makes them fear for their lives. So it's very real on both sides, right? This like fear that fear for our lives, and that's kind of creating that culture war, right? So yeah, very very, I mean, I'm like, am I really gonna do this? But I was so geeking out on it, and I was like, I have to figure this out. And so the book really kind of portrays, it's a lot about the media because I don't know what's true actually. But I can put forward this kind of dichotomy that's present and hopefully, find some kind of centrism in the middle of it, some kind of sanity. Because as we watch that 2020 election play out, like Trump did not drain the swamp. Then the right's like obsessed with pedophiles. It's like a whole, it's a very strange, it's insanity actually. That's kind of what it is. So it's like kind of like I feel like both sides are lies, and there's almost like there's almost like a split now between the population of people who are political and people who are just totally apathetic. And I think now there's so many more people who are just entirely apathetic after the hysteria that we went through and just how awful people were to each other who had differing points of view. So
Okay, so you're kind of like the book's like documenting where, like, say, kind of like 2020 forward, the different things that happened, the different tensions, conflicts, situations, the confusion, the different polarities. And then, do you have a message or do you have a way forward that you are advocating?
Oh, I haven't finished writing it totally, but I think the way forward is it's pretty simple, but it's more like a peace building approach and a more of a really deep listening to the other sides. And that's what I've attempted to do in ingesting all this media that I normally would kind of villainize.
Got it.
And so, yeah, it's just if anything, it's almost like it's probably going to be all right, everyone. And yeah, but it is interesting. Like my mother looked me in the eye when I was talking to her about all this, and she's like, "Allison, there's gonna be another pandemic, you know?" And so, because there's pandemics all the
How does
time.
she know that?
Well, right, I'm like, oh, World Health Organization. But you know, it's interesting because it's like, what is this next black swan event? I've heard people from who like work in government pretty high up in the more like right wing so like associations say like the US is already under attack from China. It's like are like you know like what is it? So I really just for my little computer researcher bystander I don't know it, but I think that the more we can empty our minds of these, I call them like viral ideologies that we do to explain our suffering, probably the happier we'll be and the easier it will be to get along with our neighbors because like these ideologies that create war and yeah, so an interpersonal conflict. So
So
yeah.
kind of like helping people to understand where the other side's coming from, to kind of humanize the other side. Definitely seems like a good starting point.
Yeah, I mean,
Sure.
a book can only accomplish so much. If I do that, that's pretty good, you know?
One of the things that I find interesting too is the media always makes everything binary. Like there's two sides, and then perception creates reality. So it does kind of become the way of things. But there's actually like a lot of sides. You know what I mean? There's a lot of different ways of looking, and there's a lot happening. I think it's, and then the sides can be different depending on the particular issue. It's actually pretty fascinating and interesting. And I know you and I had some conversations about this over the years. So that could be helpful too, of like, okay, this is us, and on every issue we're like this, and these are the evil people on every issue. And it's like when you start talking to people aren't that black and white. You know, there's a lot of complexity, there's a lot of diversity of way people look at things and feel things. So that I think that's interesting too, to kind of like, even there's even divisions within the Republican Party, divisions within the Democratic Party. Culturally, there's different phenomena. I was talking to this woman from Italy today, and she was saying how she wanted to, her dream is to come visit America. And I was talking about some events I was doing and stuff here, but she was talking about she wants to come to, her dreams come to America. And I said, yeah, it's come. It's so fun right now. Everyone's fighting. It's great. You know? And I was joking, but it actually, if you can just kind of like step back, like it is very interesting. You know, like people can be really freaked out in that kind of existential like fight or flight thing. But I like when you said it's all gonna be all right. 'Cause it's like, yeah, we're moving through something that's going somewhere, you know, and just kind of like having that perspective. I guess it's kind of like the larger view, the meta view perspective, which is probably part of the problem actually, because it's like America is like everything is like the whole world is like 4 years now. You know what I mean? Where maybe more like the indigenous approach of like maybe more like 700 years. You know, looking at things from that perspective would be much more helpful for us. But anyway.
Yeah, I travel a lot, and one time
Yes, you do.
I was talking to someone there, and he was like, he basically said to me, he's like, I think America is where all these social issues are actually going to get resolved for the rest of the world, because I feel almost like the throat chakra of the planet, because like Americans feel so entitled to our First Amendment rights, and we're all we're pretty well educated comparatively, so we're able to kind of form these abstract thoughts, and we fight online, we all have access to the internet. All these different reasons why kind of this hashing out that we do that is not exactly comfortable, although it is fascinating to study. Perhaps there are ripple effects that happen where we are in some ways like creating cultural trends through this processing that we do out loud with each other.
What about social media? Like, I think there's a sort of a consensus. I don't know what your opinion is, but I'm hearing a lot of people kind of coming to this realization that social media has been kind of a bad thing in many ways for our discourse and the way we see each other, interact with each other. What's your feeling on that?
I was just reading a Substack, which I'm now on Substack too. My name of my publication is Culture Wars, to kind of talk about all. But anyways, I was on Substack and I started reading an article from a man who was talking about the state of the culture, and he was saying that culture used to be art and entertainment, and now it's barely any of those. It's really just about distraction, and that distraction takes on a form of dopamine addiction, and that like our culture has become like this dopamine fuel. This is how we're getting our information. And that it's just so much of the content that's out there is not actually, it's degenerating culture, essentially. It's like degenerating relationships. It's degenerating our attention spans, and sometimes I personally question if I still want to write books, because I feel like the attention spans of people are so short. I'm just writing to myself, because it's just not that type of like investigative journalism, or ways that people just gathered information in the past, and these more slower ways of being. It's just no more, right? And so like I wonder if these things are becoming like lost art forms in a way, and social media is definitely the reason behind that, So, and on another level, it does give everyone a platform to share their voice, right? Which also allows these conversations to be had, right? So I don't know, it's kind of like anything, a double-edged sword in my mind, but yeah, like definitely you can see, I can see like these mind viruses. It's how I see them, is through social media in many ways, and how they engage and what they're posting and what aspects of the human condition they're kind of appealing to for their own, the building of their own empire, so to speak. Yeah, and it's pretty low, it's pretty base level by and large.
I wonder if there's, I think maybe it's already happening. If it's already happening, if there's going to be a counter movement to this where it's more like people, let's like I can envision this, I can almost like feel and envision this counter movement of like, okay, this is going a bad direction. And let's like spend more time talking to each other. Let's spend more time being in the forest. Let's spend more time reading books. Let's spend more time, in out the bonfires and, in getting into the body. And I feel like, and the thing is, you won't see it in the media because the media wants more of your attention. So it's not going to be really reported necessarily. So it's an interesting thing, but I do feel like, I guess in the conversations I'm having, people are like, whoa, we don't want to go into some kind of technocratic control grid. We actually want to like be human and, connect with each other on a human level and community and, decentralization. feels like there's something happening that I think I know you've been thinking about these kind of inquiries as well.
Yeah, that's another kind of aspect of things that makes this time period different. Is this AI, this technology kind of explosion, this whole, if you know, the conspiracies are like, this is how they're gonna get us to turn into robots and
Well, but they do talk openly about there are the transhumanists, got the guy's name. There's several people that are quite, even Elon Musk, he has the idea of the, what's that thing that goes in your brain? Neuralink.
Neuralink. Yeah. I mean, it's, you see these things and you're like, okay, these are trends that are happening. Right. It's what's more interesting is like how they convince us to get on board. But yeah, I'm sure like what I see is there's always polarization, right? Whatever. The opposite is all is going to simultaneously rise in force alongside whatever movements happen.
So the as things intensify on one side, it can kind of create the catalyst for something to rise on the other side. So something that would be more, I'm seeing something that's more, it's funny because it's like it's almost like it's going back in a way, but it's like going forward. But it's like connecting to, I mean, just basic things like connecting more to nature, connecting more to other human beings, connecting with each other. Well, I don't know if the word organic, like an organic way of living.
Well, I got my overalls on over here the woods, so I'm trying it, but I'll tell you the simple life is complicated too. This work on the land and so like I idealized it and I dreamed about it and I was like, this is a lot. So yeah, but I think that's what I saw the most during that time period of 2020 to 2022 was that the polarization was so high, like in every single way that population could be split, like the voices were arising, right? Whether it's like what type of medicine you believed in, backlashes against feminism, like just,
The whole like Andrew Tate thing, right?
yeah, which he, I studied him for a while too. Yeah, he like, and then these figures like Andrew Tate arise and they say these very controversial things, but they're touching on pain points, right, that exist inside a large enough amount of people that they become famous. And like you are saying, like actually the reality is like complexity and all these issues, but it seems like figures like Andrew Tate kind of like come up with one.
Well, yeah, I see a couple. He's interesting in a couple ways. So, and I've talked to my son is 22 right now, and I've talked to him extensively, and he's connected to people obviously his age. And it feels like he there was must a lot of stuff's like supply and demand, right? So there was definitely this demand, like the Me Too movement started out really doing a really, important thing, and then it kind of went into some other areas that were not positive for anybody, I feel like. And the patriarchy and all of this stuff, there was a sense of like young men, they weren't having any kind of a avenue to step into their masculinity, basically. And they were being told that was bad, that that was, that's shouldn't be aggressive, you shouldn't be competitive, you shouldn't be assertive, all of these things are bad. And then this guy comes out and he's saying, no, it's good to be masculine. But then he's taking it in a very kind of unconscious, immature, he's not a mature man. He's not a mature masculine man, but he is a masculine man. So, and I think the other part where social media comes in is he's saying things that are really provocative and really like sensational and really kind of like I noticed the things that go viral are usually things that upset people. You know what I mean? It's not usually things that make people feel, sometimes it is, but more, I'd say, percentage is things that upset people or enrage people. So he's upsetting people and enraging people. And then he goes viral and it becomes this viral sensation, which is kind of the way to become a viral sensation. If you're kind of like, if you don't have a positive, like if you don't care morally and you just like, how do I get attention? I would tell someone, be really, upsetting and enrage people, and you'll get lots. That's what Trump does. That was his way of kind of like getting on the map as far as the presidential candidacy. So my sense of Andrew Tate is like he was pointing at something that really resonated with young men. And as I'm talking to the young men, they're kind of realizing now that okay, but he was also not a conscious, mature version of what we're going for. And there are mature, conscious versions that we can aspire to beyond that.
Yeah, the whole sex trafficking accusation is when I started to, well, he was so interesting, right? Because he's preaching. I agree with you completely that there's this demoralization of men and masculinity that's taken place, and it's almost like it's very challenging. I still like grapple with it myself around, what does it mean to be masculine or what does it mean to be feminine and but Andrew Tate, while he does sometimes speak of things almost like Jordan Peterson of like this moral backbone and returning traditional roles that actually have some kind of sanctity to them, there's also this other like weird toxic masculine, I guess you could call it, message that he's giving, which is start a webcam ring with all the girls that you seduce. And I think he was like found not guilty for the trafficking, but then that's like where the female pain body really comes in around masculinity is like, hey, we're being like raped and sold and oppressed. And so it's like it's weird. It's like, okay, he's this voice for these men who are now feeling oppression and particularly probably inside of romantic relationships where they feel like they're losing power or who they are is being
I think it's deeper than that. So I resonate with what you're saying. I think you brought up a good point in my mind. So there's all these studies right now that show like the younger generation, like 20s. What's the younger generation called? What are they called?
they're Gen Z.
Generation
I
Gen
wouldn't
Z.
know
Gen
that.
Z.
I wouldn't know that.
So they're having less sex. They're more single. They're more like lonely and depressed. This is for both men and women, but it's even more so for the men, interestingly. So I think that you have a lot of these young men, they don't have any sex, they don't have any girlfriend, they're watching porn, they're playing video games, and they're kind of upset about it. And that's, to me, you have to take responsibility within yourself, but for the point is they're upset, and then they find this guy that's like, yeah, I have lots of sex, and my life's awesome, and here's how you do it. So they don't know any better, so they gravitate toward that because they don't have that in their life. And again, some of the stuff he's saying will work, but it's not going to get you a mature, conscious, loving, intimate relationship that you ultimately want.
Yeah, I have a friend who we always talk about patriarchy stuff, and he said something to me. I thought it was really interesting. He's like, women can complain all they want about patriarchy, but the patriarchy is instilled because women are hypergamous, right? And so it's like the fact that like a douchebag like Andrew Tate can slay like any woman because he has muscles, because he has money, because he like portrayed himself as being like, alpha status. That's why men want to be like him, because that's who gets attention from women, right? So, and it's a very deep thing. Like our friend Alicia Deva, has this theory too that it's just throughout the however many years, 4,000, 5,000 years that patriarchy has been a social construct, that women are just, our sexuality is like totally wired that way. And And that's what we want. Like we are only attracted to a very small percentage of the men out there, and the average man just feels totally invisible. Well, how are they going to combat that? By like going to Andrew Tate's little university, you know, right? So it's interesting. It's all interesting, and I find all this stuff really fascinating to analyze. So just
and
talk
it's good
about
because
it.
This is part of the culture war, so it's very interesting
Yes.
to like understand both sides of it. So I think you brought another good point in my consciousness about Andrew Tate. So yeah, so his message is, if you want to get, you know, a hot girl, then like you gotta have a lot of money, you gotta have a lot of material things. That's what really matters. Don't listen to the bullshit, it's all fake. Like money, material things, that's what's gonna get you a woman. So again, that's a part of the equation. Like there's something there that's true. Science would support that, but there's something higher, which is the spiritual component, which is like he's been missing, you know. And I actually have the book here somewhere. The men's mastermind group that I'm leading, we're reading Way of the Superior Man by David Deida, reading a chapter a week. And I hadn't read that book in a long time, so I'm kind of looking at it in a way almost like a little bit fresh from where I am now. And he's really putting the emphasis on what attracts a woman to a man being his presence. In other words, when he's present, when he's fully here in the moment, when he's really attentive. I think those other things are components, like, you know, the man is like this, the sense of provide and protect and that kind of a thing, right? But I think, especially if it's a woman that's on a spiritual path, like the material things and the money is not going to be the most important thing. I think it's a factor, but the most important thing will be his presence and his attentiveness and his integrity and, you know, honesty and sense of humor and sense of purpose. That's a big one. So those are things that I think that he was lacking in his message. But he touched that particular nerve that those young men were missing and got the, you know, connected and hooked them in.
Yeah, and it goes into this whole Me Too thing as well, of this like predatorial, I guess you could say, like aspect of masculinity, like this predator prey type. It's hard to, but to me, Andrew Tate really kind of like embodies a little bit of that predator energy, which like the feminism is all angry about, right? And in many ways, like rightfully so, but like, yeah, it's all things I'm still sorting through. But I think I have heard Andrew Tate speak on videos like since his whole arrest, and he does actually seem to be kind of mellowing out.
I heard that he's going in a better direction lately.
He's going in a better direction. So to me, it's like the pendulum swings, right? And when it swings far, we get to see kind of these flaws in our thinking and flaws in our conditioning and flaws in our patterning, and people like him get to be the kind of cultural scapegoat, but really like his cognitive distortions exist inside of so many people, right?
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. So I think that's interesting. Whoever your person is that you think is some kind of dark force on the planet, whether, you know, Trump or Tate or whoever the other people are, there's many of them. I think the interesting question is, many people are resonating. So that's the more interesting, because that's just one person. But when you have millions of people that are resonating with a message or what's putting out, that's more interesting. Like, why are people resonating? There's something, in other words, there's something, I don't know what you'd call it, something that they find valuable there, right? Or else they wouldn't be paying this person attention and, you know, engaging on such a so much of their time.
Yeah, with Tate, I think it was just this rampant kind of feeling of emasculation amongst men, and he was combating it and being like, that's the enemy, like, that, right? And and for me, he woke me up because I'm like, oh, this guy triggers me, you know. So now I have to do all this work around like removing my enemy out picturing of him because he's just like a dude, right? Online, who I'm never gonna meet. Yeah, and he really brought more of this victim perpetrator thing, right? So yeah, it was like he's pointing to a pain, an aspect of the male pain body that needs healing. Yeah, tension, right? Needs balancing out. So, and Andrew Tate did that for us. Thank you, Andrew. Yeah. And it's interesting too. It sometimes it seems like maybe like a year ago, the energy of the gender war aspect of the whole cultural battling that's happening seemed much more high, like it was peaking, and then I could almost feel, I'm pretty energetically sensitive, I could feel like when it just dropped out, you know, like I could feel when it was like this is just dropping out, and then people, it drops out because people stop talking about it, like people stop paying attention to it, and then the I guess you could say like the hook or the control it has on us seems to almost completely disappear. It's very interesting. Racism, I think, is a very similar topic to like the gender stuff too, because that was so up in the collective. It almost made you feel like we were still in the 1940s, right? Like of how much racism exists in the US, and you know, the media makes you feel like there's like lynchings happening every day, and the KKK is like headquartered everywhere. I'm sure there's some KKK people out here in Marshall, like, so, but it's good, but it's real, right? It's there. And for some of us, it's so interesting too, because I have some friends who are Black and they're like, I don't experience racism that much. And then others, it's much more insidious. And I sometimes wonder if it's almost like karmic for certain souls, like certain souls come in and they have deeper amounts of these patterning and wounding that they have to work through. And yeah, I started reading this book called The War on the West, and in it he kind of
Who's the
talks about,
author?
I'd have to look him up, but it's a
Okay.
great book and I would
All right.
totally recommend it, because he does kind of dissect actually the events of 2020 and on from a conservative lens, but it's very not conspiratorial. But his whole thing is that there's actually like a war on Western culture happening, and that the radical left is using identity politics as a way to kind of dismantle the Constitution and demonize Western civilization, when actually there are a lot of virtues to it as well, and a lot of freedoms that it has provided the world.
I always think it's strange when, not even strange, like comically hypocritical when feminist women are like really against the West and against like America. It's like try living in Saudi Arabia for a few weeks, see how that goes.
Our friend Kara is in Egypt right
Egypt,
now, and she, you know, she'll call me and she'll be like, you can complain all you want, but you try living under radical Islam. You know, she's like, there is no platform, like,
Well, there you
there's
go.
no
That's my point.
freedom. Right.
That's my point.
And this is also part of this culture, a global culture war around religion, around all these things that are happening. Even what you could say, what's happening in Israel right now, could be also interpreted as this kind of like war over Western culture, because Israel is the one kind of democratic Western country in all of the Middle East, right? I've always wondered, I'm like, why does the US like have such a deep alliance with Israel? And you know, there's the Holocaust and other things like that. But for whatever reason, we do live on a planet where we definitely like fight and destroy each other based on belief and identity. And like how that all factors into like political power, right? And these like structures of society, and radical Islam is definitely one of them, right? That's
Well, I think that I guess my point is like being in when you're an American and you're living in America and you're not you don't travel much, or maybe you don't travel at all. You travel very little. If you do travel, you're going to like some Cancun or whatever, where it's the same thing basically. Like I think having some perspective, you can kind of lose perspective, and you can lose appreciation, and you just think America is just this horrible, horrific, terrible place, you know? And I mean, we're part of the human condition, so the human condition is tough. It's a tough journey we signed up for, but I think it is valuable to kind of tune into some other places, and it gives you perspective on appreciating some things of your own life. You know, that would be helpful for people.
That was a trend I definitely saw after the events of COVID and all of that, is that I found, like, I saw like way more people being like, actually, like, this place isn't so bad. We don't need to dismantle it to the very ground. And in the book, The War on the West, he divides it into like the identity politic camp and the nationalist camp, which Trump very much signifies the nationalist camp. And those are people who kind of have a sense of pride and pride of country, right? And I saw a lot of people start to realize how much privilege we have here, and how it's not as bad as these people are painting it out to be. So
Like when if I tune into the media, this includes alternative media, it's pretty much all like just how horrible America is right now, and how, you know, it's all negative about the state of America, right? So I've been thinking about this. I'm looking at this like border crisis on the southern border, right? And I'm like, okay, well, if it's so bad, then why are all these people like sacrificing their lives to try to get across the border, like thousands and thousands of people every day? Like, you know what I mean? It doesn't kind of like add up. Like, if it's so bad, then like everyone seems to want to come here. Not everyone, but many people seem to want to come here. And I'm even talking to, like I mentioned someone earlier, like some people talking to other countries are like, we want to move to America, and how can we do it? And so it's interesting. I think we've kind of lost some perspective, you know, about just what we have compared to other parts of the world. And I think that alone could be helpful, you know, for Americans.
It's funny, 'cause like one of the reasons why I do feel compelled to write this book is because I published my last book when I was 29, I'm 36 now, and I very much like was in
Yeah, me
those
too.
kind of thought patterns, right? And in many ways that is a product of almost higher education, is that they build these thought patterns, which is also like part of this culture war against like the education system, and that it's like liberal indoctrination, right? And it teaches you to hate your country. It teaches you to feel like a victim based on your identity. It teaches these ways of thinking. And it's interesting, I started like mentoring a young person, and he's very much like in that radical left way of thinking. And I'm just like, this is not productive. Like, this is not going to help you like succeed in life. If anything, it's like depressing,
I
you know,
think that's the key.
really
It's not a
depressing.
recipe for success.
No.
That's the thing.
Yeah, I started like when all this stuff was happening, I always thought conservatives were just like the villains. And I'm not saying that they're not as, I mean, both sides are pretty illogical in a lot of ways, but I started to be like, well, who's happier? And I'm like, I think these guys actually look happier. Like, they have families, they have successful businesses, they're not like in a complete emotional hysteria if you like trigger them by saying the wrong word. There seems to be like a sense of acceptance with how the world works. You know, for me too, I used to think of like the individualism of the United States as being something that was evil, or like part of the problem of why there was so much suffering. But then, you know, I never really looked too much into communist countries where it's like this whole collectivism is the unifying ideal. And then it's just like everyone's poor, no one has freedom, no one can say anything. And so like the people who are more conservative minded, they're able to look at the individualism of the country and deem it a virtue, right? And like almost seize it to be like, my fate is not dependent on those around me. Like I create my own fate, right? And that America is a country where I think people are fighting from all over the world to be here because it does provide the tools for that to be so, you know, instead of just being stuck in poverty, under a ruthless dictator, the way that like tons of other countries operate, right? And so that whole time has just been such a huge paradigm shift for me. I wanted to write a book because I'm like, if my lasting impact on the world are these thoughts that I thought 6 years ago, I'm like, I don't think that way really anymore. And it was just like I was just a younger version of myself. And it's also like part of the challenge of writing is that you're writing out and you're like printing just your way of thinking, and that is so subject to change. So I think I'm writing this book. So I'm like, I want to be remembered as like more so like how I see things now. And perhaps it's just a more mature perspective. Yeah.
What have you looked at, like what's your take on like what people would consider like traditional values, I guess we could call it? Like, has anything revised or shifted around that?
Yeah, I kind of started to go into that a little more around like, oh, we should adopt just regular gen, like we should go back to being more gender roley or whatever. And partially, I think my land was that. There was like a 2 year period of my life where I was working in completely male dominated industries and I was like the only woman. And I was just like dealing with a bunch of stuff because of that. And it actually made me realize I'm like, oh, this sexism thing is very real still. But like also doing all these masculine activities and realizing I'm like, maybe this isn't like actually what my body thrives doing. And then so I started to be like, well, maybe there is some kind of I don't know, biological template that you would, and that goes into the whole gender dysphoric kind of world where we're questioning so deeply what it even means to be male or female, and if that's something that you can choose, and blah blah blah. That's a whole, the transgenderism thing is like a whole, and the non-binary thing is a whole different can of worms. But then I started to also see the aspects of it that are like oppressive towards women, and like why maybe something maybe in between the two might be good, like a balance between the two. But I think what makes America great is that you actually do have the freedom to choose whatever
Carve your own
life
path.
style works for
Yeah,
you,
that
right?
works for
So
you. Yep.
it's like, okay, it's just about more so in my mind, like each individual finding a dynamic
Yep.
that works, right? And this whole idea of like polarity and like how for a man and a woman to thrive inside of a intimate partnership and how much like embodying certain traits that are different than each other goes into that, I don't know. But it's definitely food for thought. It's definitely it's definitely something to consider. But I honestly, maybe the biggest problem is that anyone who comes to a conclusion feels like they need to enforce it on others as the right way to live. Like these people online, they're just like, no, this is it. Like this is the way to buy my course. No.
That's a good point. That's your way. It doesn't need to be everybody's way. And it's most likely, probably, almost assuredly not everyone else's way. Yeah. I think what I see with feminism is interesting. I see kind of two stages. Like initially is like okay, so it's like this movement for power, for empowerment, let's say, for empowerment. And then it's like the first movement was like basically I always think of it as masculinism, not feminism, because it was like we're gonna do what the men do, and we can we you know it's like we want to do what the men do, and then it was like what I with the circle of women that I've talked with now, pretty much universally they're like, we don't want to do what the men do. We wanna the I think the realization now is like accessing the feminine power, you know, and realizing that you don't have to have you don't have to empower yourself by doing masculine but through the masculine qualities, that there's a feminine power that's equally powerful than the masculine power and has its own magic and its own gifts to it. And I feel like that's the exploration that I feel happening now with like the women that I really respect. And kind of like what you said, like even when I in the women I'm like coaching or working with, it's like when they're really in this kind of like masculine paradigm all day, they're just like, even their bodies are like, you know, it's like there's not like a softness and a fluidity and a movement and openness. And it just, you know, and I will say there are some women that are more masculine and that does work for them. But, you know, the majority of women, I think, are stepping into the feminine power. And you know, yeah, relaxing into that.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like the world, the pressures of the world or whatever our cultural attempts to solve these issues are kind of pressuring women to be more masculine and men to be more feminine, but that doesn't necessarily I don't know, that's not maybe that's not helping either. It is interesting, you know, if you are a single woman and you do have to provide for yourself, and you are in like a certain work situation, like for me, my firsthand experience is it's really hard to like be feminine, especially if you're being like sexually harassed for being beautiful or pressured to sleep with your boss or, you know, like all these things, right? It's actually I haven't arrived at completely like what is the hack, unless you it seems like a lot of women just like become self-employed priestesses and they're like, this is how I'll stay in my power. But there is maybe ways of going about manifesting things or accomplishing things that don't need to be like masculine. You can still be just as effective. It's just from the female perspective, I do empathize with the challenge that it like how challenging it can be to like stay in that space in the world. And also like we can't use that either as an excuse, right? For like why we can't just be natural inside of our selves. But the conditionings are there and they're real, and we all have to do kind of work to dismantle them so like some kind of more authentic deconditioned identity can emerge, right?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that the way it would have to work is you'd have to have be in a relationship with someone, be married to someone or have a boyfriend, or just have someone who's your circle of friends or a community or someone you're paying to take on those masculine roles so you can be in the feminine role. If you don't have anybody, then yeah, then you have to do it yourself.
Yeah. Like I've been in partnership now for 8 months and I'm like, oh, now I can be in my feminine. But when I'm like running my homestead all by myself and like hustling to make money, you know, I'm like, you know, you I'm like, it's not gonna work. Like I have to be like that. And then I was also noticing exactly like what you were saying, like my body stiffening and hardening up and me getting this like attitude where I'm very angry, you know, and then like I'm so interested in like this if like I don't know how we would examine this, but the correlation between like the law of attraction and the amount of like perceived oppression that you or oppression that you experience, right? Like is it like a vibrational like do you, can we vibrate beyond these paradigms inside of a country like this, where there's, you know, enough of the alternative, you know, there's enough like kind, decent people. And it goes on to the question you were talking about earlier. It's like, what's the point of the book? Like, what's the way forward? Like, I really just feel like we just have to treat each other as humans and stop breaking down all this stuff. And we all just want respect and certain decencies. But yeah, I'm so curious, because like I went through a period where I was like experiencing so much of that, and now I haven't like had any of it for like, you know, almost a year, and I'm like, hallelujah, you know, like how do we liberate ourselves, right? Like how do we liberate ourselves from these dynamics? Because the reason why so many people are upset about racism and sexism and the whole left movement, decolonization, indigenous right, like all that stuff, is because they experience oppression, right? Because of it. But then there's other people who don't.
There's another thing though that's very important to bring up. Yes and no. I think a lot of people that I've encountered that are really into the, I don't know what to call it, that are really into what you're talking about, are people that are like Ivy League, like really privileged, really educated. They almost feel some kind of like guilt or shame that I think we've talked about this. Like it's so they get really into like people who are oppressed because they feel bad about like their own life, that they weren't oppressed or that they weren't, you know what I'm saying? I know you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, totally. But that's also part of the liberal value structure, right?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's like we are the anti-racism. They're like, it's your job as a white person to spend the rest of your life dismantling systemic racism. You're like, whoa.
It's almost like I mean, honestly, it's almost like your life is like too boring. Like if you just grow up and you're like wealthy, and I mean, I know you grew up in a pretty wealthy family, right? So I can ask you this question, right? So if you grow up and like, you're like pretty wealthy and you're in really nice like suburbs and, you know, the lawns are all cut. And then like, it's almost like you need something more. And it's, you know what I mean? It's like, I think that we, and I'm kind of thinking it through as I'm talking, it's like, I think that we need to be challenged. Like we do need a certain amount of adversity to like grow and to learn and to evolve and to awaken. And so like, if we don't have that, we'll kind of like try to live it through other people and like find some other groups that, you know, we can like kind of like be a part of their journey. And then also, there's the whole thing of like feeling, this is actually really important. Like it's not really talked about, but there's so much shame and guilt happening for white people, people of European descent, right now. And it's not healthy to feel guilt and shame, at least not for any kind of prolonged period of time. It's not healthy for anybody, including the people you're relating with, interacting with. So that's an interesting phenomenon too, that's not really like talked about, but it's not good.
Yeah, that was one of the paradigm shifts, I think, too, I went through during that period, where I was like, you know, I would always like be shamed for being privileged and whatnot, and very much like devoted the majority of my career efforts towards like helping disadvantaged.
That's what I'm saying.
Disadvantaged populations.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, and then it's like, you're still hated and you're the reason why. And then you're like, I barely make enough money to survive because all I do is like try to solve someone else's problems. And you know, working in the addiction recovery field, or anyone who works in the mental health field will tell you, like, there are people who just come from like, so like have every resource and they flounder and they never get better. And they, you know, so like how much of, our success and failure is based on our own, like some aspect of our inner constitution, right? Like some fortitude, or resilience, or optimism, or being able to just like be someone that people enjoy being around, no matter how much trauma you've had to endure or whatever, you know. And I think that like privilege very well might be part of the coin of why some people fail and some people succeed, but it's certainly not the determining factor. Like in my experience, it has something way more to do with some kind of like spirit that's inside of you and whatever drive you have. And I guess, you know, I guess like America's a place where if you bring that forward day after day and work your ass off, that, you know, you can really like in one generation, like totally change your family's circumstances, right?
Yeah.
So it's interesting. So I also like stopped with the whole charity thing. I stopped with it because I realized it was this like deep-seated self-loathing that had been instilled inside of me that was like guiding a lot of my choices. They're like, you know, go woke, go broke. Because it's like, you will, like, you'll just like keep giving everything you have to be redeemed from this original sin of being like born into a white middle class family, you know? And you're like, it can never wash away. It's almost like this Catholic guilt or something. But it's definitely not healthy. And it's interesting too, because it comes into the whole socialism thing where it's like people feel like if the government just like wrote a check for everyone, whether it be reparations, whether it be some kind of like safety net. I'm not saying that we don't need them, but like the real, like somehow.
Just giving people money is going to solve their problems.
Yeah, but you're not changing like their mindset of how they'd spend it, right? Yeah. Or like you know, how, like that kind of stuff. So then that's what, you know, like they say, these communist countries are just like everyone's poor. Because like the money eventually goes away.
So this kind of goes back to like, actually kind of circles back to the Andrew Tate point of like privilege. Privilege is like, oh, you have money and you have wealth and you have material things and you have houses and cars and, you know, vacation homes. And it's like, when I'm really like feeling into it right now, I'm like, that's okay. So I think if I would think like, what is the greatest privilege? It would be like, having parents that like really love you and like really care for you and make you a priority and be attentive to you. And like, that would be a better gauge of like a child that's going to grow up, you know, healthy and fulfilled and successful, even from like a modest income, than a child that's like super duper billionaire parents that like are totally neglecting them, you know, and on drugs and, you know, whatever, not really present for the child. I just care about status and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I've met plenty of them too. So, right? And like very miserable people who have all those external indicators of privilege, right? And it's just not holistic. But that's, you know, that's everyone's journey, right? That's everyone's journey.
But I just think that's a deeper, because like people will be like, oh, you're so privileged because you grew up wealthy. Doesn't mean necessarily they were privileged. That's one factor, you know, but there's more essential factors that would indicate privilege. And then there are people that are more privileged than other people, for sure. And I think if you are more privileged, then be grateful and be appreciative, you know? And then sure, if you can help other people with what you have, that would be the ultimate human journey to take, is to be a benefit to others and be of highest benefit to the world.
Yeah, I also don't want to come off like I'm blind to the systemic whatever, you know, that word needs to go through with a fine tooth comb around like how much of this civil rights stuff has been dismantled, how much of this like poverty is like systemic and in a loop. You know, I'm sure there's tons of statistics that say like, you know, most people don't make it out of the hood or whatever, right? Like, I'm not trying to be like, because I think when I started going through this swing of examining the other side, I got a little, maybe a little numb to the hardships that others that I used to be so like engulfed in being like a savior to save. And I think that's actually what makes people hate the right so much, is that they almost like, it feels like they're gaslighting all the like people who don't have it so good, and kind of like hold on to the left as like the good guys that are going to do things to help their situation in this country. They kind of make it seem like, oh, all your trauma is your fault, right? Or this doesn't exist. It's all in your mind. But you know what we saw like during Me Too, when all the women are coming forth with their like horror stories of being assaulted, or for Black Lives Matter, where you hear all this like horrible, like all these like this horrible violence that the Black community experiences, and that like racism is real, and you know all that stuff is, it's still here. I just don't want to come off like I'm insensitive to that, because I definitely acknowledge it. I just I don't know. I would love to find a way forward that is balanced in those two perspectives, because just learning to balance them myself through the process of writing this book like has helped me become a better person, right? And not be victim to my own kind of like swinging around my worldview that traps me in a box, right?
Yeah.
Right. That
yeah
makes
I think you just happy. Yeah, I think you just answered the question. Like, so I think like having compassion, empathy for others is like always important, you know. And you know, I guess like humility of like, we haven't completely walked in someone else's shoes, right? So that there's that component. And then it's like, okay, so someone's in a really difficult situation, and they grew up in that situation, and like, what's the way out of that situation? That's the important question, right? And I think it's pretty clear that like being in a victimization consciousness is not going to help you to get out of the situation. That's just the fact of the matter. And so your story, what you're telling me is like me shifting that consciousness is like improving my life and opening me up to different levels. And I think that that's universal. You know, that's a universal story around the world, no matter what your color is, your gender is, your orientation. That's a universal truth. And also, you know, sometimes people have healing that they need to move through first before they're ready to take that step. And so, you know, we have need of empathy for that as well, compassion for that.
Yeah, you know, maybe resources for that too, right? But yeah, I mean, I definitely feel like I'm dead in the center now as far as my political. I see both sides very clearly, and I see the logic in both sides, the need for both sides. And my understanding is that America was created so that both of those sides could balance each other out inside the legislative congressional progress. But what we have is a culture war instead, where not much gets done. Because they view the other as the problem, right? So in my own little, inside my own soma, I have attempted to make peace. And hopefully, to whatever extent that this book.
You're feeling called to be a messenger of a bridge between the two, between the divide.
Yeah, because I had to do it with my parents, you know, with everything that happened. And like humanizing them, you know. It's not easy, like having people say, you know, your parents are involved in like the engineering of a global Holocaust. Like that's like not easy to go through. And then like in my and this is the first time I've ever publicly spoken about this, but yeah, like it, and like, and then I'm at the kitchen table. My mom's like screaming to deploy like millions of vaccines to Africa to save people's lives. She's like, Allison, there's like They're burning bodies on the street of China. Like 4 million people have died. Like, what's wrong with you? Like, why don't you believe this is a big thing? You know, like that whole perspective of the experts. And like, I promise you, my father knows so much more about vaccines than like almost anyone on the planet, right? Like he knows about vaccines. But like in my heart, I'm like, this doesn't resonate with me, you know? Like, I don't necessarily like this doesn't add up for me. But like to like really see where they were coming from and to make peace with that, and then for them to have to make peace with me that I don't see it that way, and we're still family, right? Because it was so intense that you know, families were breaking apart. Like it was tearing apart like families and friends, and you had to pick a side. And if you your side was this side, then you would hang out with other people who saw the world your way. And the whole thing was just so fascinating in how we all thought the other person was like going to kill us if they thought differently. But in the reality, like it wasn't even that big of a deal, you know? Like we all created this giant kind of like battle between each other that never needed to be there, but like it was there because the media, you know,
Yeah,
facilitated
that's what I was
it.
gonna ask is like how much of this is like genuine and how much of this is like intentionally created by other forces that have their own agenda to keep people divided and separate.
Yeah, I mean, my father and I was showing it to him. I'm like, Dad, I'm not picking sides. Like, I'm not gonna like do that to the family. Like, I really like am honored to be a member of the family and that you guys have accomplished so much. But yeah, my dad was just like 50% of this book should be about the media. He was like, cause that in and of itself, like he was like the PR that happened, like while we were trying to like globalize a response to this. And you know, I showed them all the things about like gain of function research and event 201, and you know, there's like an extent that they're like, you know, but you can always show another article saying that that's not true. So it's like the way it's very hard to piece together like what is true because the media has one side and it's like this is a whistleblower and this is the truth, right? And then there's censorship happening and like all, you know, everything that we went through. But then there's also going to be like a CNN article, right, about how that's not true. And so I kind of like feel less inspired to figure out the truth and more inspired to just kind of showcase how the media works to manipulate our emotions and like manipulate our affiliations, right? Like incite certain affiliations. And I've talked to a lot of people, they're like, I like my only way of kind of rising above what all happened. And I think we haven't even had the conversation that we're having right now, largely. It was like we just went through this giant, very
Yeah,
prolonged.
people seem to just be kind of like not wanting to deal with it.
Yeah, they're like, it's over. We don't have to wear a mask. We like the business. They're like, shut up. They're like, just like, don't talk about it. It's like it never happened, right? But we're like, it happened for like 2 years and we were awful, you know? Like we were really bad to each other. There was like the psychological term is like splitting, right? You're splitting into black and white thinking. And I do think that maybe there is something in the collective that would benefit from having conversations. It almost feels like people have given up and people are like, the only way I can handle this is to kind of like vibrate beyond even like giving a caring anymore about politics or like because like it was like both sides, like the wool was just like over our eyes on both sides, like the lies from both sides. It's just it was like wow, like this was a giant, I think it was a psyop, you know, like it was a giant psyop, but it wasn't as crazy as these conspiracy people were making it out to be, the whole Q thing, the whole, all that stuff was, not true. And it's just so interesting how people just like latch on to these things. And I think there has been this kind of mass, like, just forget about it. And also just being like, I'm not going to even pay attention anymore because this is damaging, right? This is like damaging mental health to pay attention. I'm interested to see how this next election, like the fervor, and if people are just going to be like, eh, it doesn't really matter who's president anyhow.
Are you really seeing that? Because I'm seeing like people are like, this is the end of the world. Whatever happens here is like the universe is going to collapse.
I mean, they thought that with Biden, like, it's fine. Like, in some ways, like, I don't know. I think there's been more sense of peace under Biden interpersonally, because Trump just does something. I mean, it's the media's portrayal of him, but it's also him. Like, he really just pisses people off, right? And he really creates a deep amount of social division and unrest. And it's been nice to have 4 years like away from that. I don't know. I'm interested to see. And that's kind of part of like why I'm waiting to release the book until the election, because it is going to also like bring in some of the more current stuff. And this is really like the continuation of that.
Maybe what it
That one.
is maybe people aren't, maybe some people aren't apathetic. Maybe they're realizing that politics or who's the president of the United States is not the ultimate solution to their problems, and that everything's not going to be solved through politics. Which, so maybe it's like actually what I would say is a good thing of realizing that, that's not. You know how you're saying there's this idea that like, oh, Donald Trump's the savior, he's gonna like save us, or I don't think anybody thinks Biden's the savior, but whoever you think is your political person that's gonna like save you, or it's like maybe people are realizing that like that has its place. Of course, that makes a difference in the world on some level, but there's other ways beyond that to positively shift your own personal life and the world, be the, I guess the saying, to quote Gandhi, be the change you want to see in the world. Maybe there's more of a realization of that element.
Yeah, or just like, how do you be happy, right? Like, I know that might sound trivial, but it's also like not that
Pretty
easy.
important.
It's, yeah, and it's like, oh, well, now we have a black female vice president, so like, now it's okay, right? No, it's, yeah, like, it's all another way to outsource power, right? Like, outsource personal power. I personally don't think it matters too much, but it's very interesting, like on both sides, if you're like hardcore left or hardcore right, the inner monologue right now is that this is the election that determines
The
like the fate
universe.
of America. Yeah. Like our democracy, like from like our democracy is totally at stake. Like if he wins, and then on the right, they're like, our democracy is
Well,
totally at
I
stake.
think, okay, I do think that what could be very problematic and is actually quite possible, either direction, is that people lose trust in presidential elections, and they lose trust in the what would you call it, the like the fiber of the process itself. That would be a problem. And it does seem like a lot of people are trending that direction. Because
I mean,
there are a lot of countries like that. I mean, you can see those countries where everyone knows that the election's a sham and no one trusts it. And it's like there's just like these kind of like an oligarchy behind the scenes that's doing what they want for their own benefit. And the media is fake. And like that would be the danger. Something to be mindful of.
I mean, I personally don't know how to engage with the voting process too much. I try to do my duty, and I like go to the ballots, and I'm like, see a bunch of random names, and like I'll even spend like hours researching these candidates and their platform, but all I see is like a website, by them saying who they are. And I'm like, I don't actually have any idea. Here I am, like, I think even in this country where we do have the, right to vote, like that could be like one site that's like publicly funded where there's a bunch of media about every single topic that explains all the positions and the things that they're voting on and search behind it and things like that. I feel like that would be an epic, that would be like an epic way to improve it. But like, I've always felt kind of disenchanted with the voting process, but I still try to do it because I'm like, oh,
This is what I'm supposed to do.
this is what I'm supposed to do. And then people think it's like, oh, who you pick for president is the only one that matters because it's the one that's like the most media about it for like, 7 months leading up to it, right? But you don't know about anybody else. It's pretty interesting. I don't know, Brian. There's a lot.
Well, it does seem like if you were someone who felt called to engage in politics in a deep way, I mean, the way you would want to engage that would make the biggest difference for sure would be locally. It's not going to be on the presidential level. I think that feels pretty clear to me. But I wanted to bring one other thing forward. I think it's very something that I think a lot of people it's made a lot of people cynical. And I think for good reason. So a lot of the so you kind of these multinational corporations, it's in their bylaws to maximize profits, right? And so what's happening now is they've realized that it's beneficial for them to maximize profits to push various or even sometimes even create kind of social justice issues. I think like the COVID thing, it's usually they'll take some like they'll really push like group that's like with the COVID thing, it was like grandmothers and grandfathers, oh, you're killing the grandparents and all this kind of thing. So they'll always have some group that like is the oppressed group that they're helping. And if you kind of look deeper, it's almost always like those are the same families that have made those people oppressed to begin with that now claim that they're helping the people who are oppressed and give them money and they're maximizing profits. It's like they're making money on both sides of it, So I do see this with the pharmaceutical industry. I see this with like the social justice industry. I see this with the defense industry, and you can name other industries too, right? But I think that's something that's, I think it's like the culture war would be one thing if it was like a genuine, like this starts, but it's not even like genuine a lot of times. It's like people are just saying things to manipulate the public to, and then that turns people off to social justice causes that they could be. I'll say for myself, like I don't trust any of the social justice institutions because of the money that they're that who funds them and what they're what they're about and what they're trying to push. So there's kind of this corruption that's happening where it makes the conversation even more muddy because it's not a genuine conversation. I just wanted to get your perception on that.
Yeah, that it, I actually wrote in the book something similar to what you were saying about this kind of like everything that people say that they're doing, like these institutions, like we're here to protect the peace, like the people who create the war, like are saying
Exactly.
to
That's a
protect,
good example. Yeah.
right? So, right, it's just it's so.
We're going to invade this country to protect the peace there.
Exactly, right? So and terrorism is real and blah blah blah, but yeah, it's all kind of illogical, right? And but if there is one guiding force that's not a conspiracy, we can like clearly s see that this is the guiding principle of the flow of capital and resources. It's that you have to make a profit, right? Like, you have to make a profit, and you have to, like the people who have all the wealth and the corporations, like where like money is aggregated, like they are the gatekeepers of like what gets funded and
And then
what doesn't.
If you talk about like Black Lives Matter or homophobia or transphobia or whatever else, they're all the different th then they think you're a good company, you know, you're doing good things. And it's pretty obvious to me that they use these things to continue to maximize profit and be in good favor of people that otherwise would definitely not be in their favor.
You know, we saw that. I think that was another like social trend that happened during that time, whereas like previously corporations would never do anything political because they would never want to alienate half of their potential customer base. But now all of a sudden it's like you have to have, you know, a sign in your window that says you're for like equal rights and you support these liberal causes.
And then meanwhile, these are the same companies that are like, you know, paying people 50 cents an hour in Africa or China to mine, you know, out of the ground. And it's like
Virtue signaling, right?
yeah, well, it's like, yeah, we know we're doing the opposite, so let's just like put this forward. And then it's like I said, it really creates this kind of massive confusion about even the re having genuine discussion about these issues, because the main players aren't even authentic that are involved in it.
Or they've convinced themselves that they're doing good. You know, it's quite the like very interesting psychological processes. But I think if I could put my finger on one thing that you're talking about, that it's a hard. It's just like it's just a confusing time. It's like it's a confusing, like how do we make sense of everything that happened? How do we move forward? Who do we trust? I think many of us have just kind of retreated into our own personal lives and tending to our families and our relationships and just making sure our businesses are doing good or just like keeping our head down with what's important. It's not all this, right? Because it is people like you and me, we love to wax poetic about it and pick all these things apart, but it is a very, very confusing time to just like discern like if any social movements are even, you know, worth putting your precious time and energy and money into, right? Because it's just so hard to know what's like real and what's not.
Yeah, definitely at least research who's behind them and what they're about. And
Yeah, the BLM thing was so disappointing, right? It's like they got like what, however many $1 million, and then you know,
that's usually how it goes.
and they're like, you know, really exploiting the black pain body, which is like real for real reasons. And yeah, it's just like it's all just this a rich man's trick. What's that documentary? It's all yeah. It's definitely disheartening
Well, you
the order.
mentioned Bill Gates earlier. I know Bill Gates, he moved to being a philanthropist, and I think he at least doubled his wealth since, if not tripled his wealth since he became a philanthropist. You know, and that's a classic trick of extremely wealthy people, is, you know, you can make more money through being a philanthropist than you can through even, you know, traditional business.
Yeah, at least the traditional business maybe is a little more, but I wouldn't even go that far to say it's more straightforward. But everyone's got to make a profit, right? Because we're living under like that is ultimate. I consider capitalism like the ultimate structure that we're living under.
Yeah, for sure.
Ultimately, globally, you know, and I get why people are upset by it, you know, and would like more socialist like reform. I get it. Like I very much get that. It's just challenging when like. I don't know what are the examples of when that's worked and not
The
just.
other side too, people will say, is that we've never ha actually had free market capitalism, truly. Like, it's what they call crony capitalism. You know, that's not genuinely open and fair.
Yeah, it's
So there's that
financialism,
side of it too.
right? It's financialism. And then you get into the whole crypto thing, right? Like the whole decentralization movement
Bitcoin.
winds up. And yeah, great. Well, we've been talking for a while.
We've been going for it. So let's wrap it up. What are your closing thoughts that you'd like to share?
Oh, just I hope that I'm able to pull this off. And actually publish this book and do what it takes, and then I, say words. I mean, maybe it would be better if I pissed everyone off, because then I could go viral. But I am really trying to do something here that's perhaps of like a higher purpose than that. I hope that if this interests you, that you will consider reading the book when it comes out and check out my Substack. And
Culture wars, right?
Allison Lee Share at substack.com. What culture wars. And yeah, I'm just gonna do my very best to like find some kind of order in this chaos that I can share. And I don't know if it's possible, but I'm gonna do my best.
Beautiful. I'd like to say that, I'd like, what you're saying about how it's such a confusing time. And when I'm kind of in that swirl of energy around me, I like to come back to, like, okay, what are the things that are kind of timeless that are always going to be true? And it's like, love, be loving, be kind, try to find inner peace. I like what you said about, like, not trying to impose your will on other people. That feels like a timeless truth. So freedom, I guess that would be in the realm of freedom. As best you can, like, being honest and telling the truth and operating from integrity as best you can, and sharing your gifts with the world.
Yeah, this was
So.
why I was on such a debate of whether or not to like go forward with this, because everything that you're saying is like that's what I've been focusing on the past few years, and I'm like this is way better than like being
Yeah,
in the
but
swirl, it's like way better than being in the swirl, but there is like an aspect. I just had this nagging thing where like this is an aspect of sharing my gift, so I'm just gonna
yeah.
go.
Well, I think what my understanding, my sense of what you're doing is you're intending to bring that into the swirl, to deswirl it a bit. Because I think the swirl is happening because people have lost that axis, that center point inside themselves. And so if we could bring that those values, like, into those conversations, they could take a whole different quality and be actually quite generative and creative, and can find positive solutions and realize that, I think, anytime there's like a polarity, I don't think you can have a polarity without both sides having some value. There's something in there, especially if you have millions of people that are, like, really adamant and passionate about one particular side. There's something there that has value, and it's like integrating the two then, right? So it feels like that's the mission you're on, which feels like a noble mission.
Thanks.
Thanks so much for being here. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and see you in the next now.